Our scripture reading this morning is also from a couple passages in Genesis. We go to Genesis chapter 1, beginning in verse 20, and we'll also read in Genesis 9. And the reason we're reading these passages is as we're considering the command that forbids the shedding of blood, the act of murder. What we hope to do today is consider a doctrine that is absolutely connected to you. And yet it's somewhat hazy in our understanding of this doctrine. It's been hazy throughout history itself. And because we don't usually study this so continuously, it becomes hazy in our understanding. And at best, we have a general concept of what the image of God in man, the image of God in humankind, in man and woman, what that means, what that is, what that does. And so we hope to consider that today. Let's read then Genesis 1, beginning with verse 20. And God said, "Let the waters bring forth abundantly the moving creature that hath life, and fowl that may fly above the earth in the open firmament of heaven." And God created great whales and every living creature that moveth, which the waters brought forth abundantly after their kind, and every winged fowl after his kind. And God saw that it was good. And God blessed them, saying, "Be fruitful and multiply, and fill the waters in the seas, and let fowl multiply in the earth." And the evening and the morning were the fifth day. And God said, "Let the earth bring forth the living creature after his kind, cattle and creeping thing and beast of the earth after his kind." And it was so. And God made the beast of the earth after his kind, and cattle after their kind, and everything that creepeth upon the earth after his kind. And God saw that it was good. And God said, "Let us make man in our image, after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the fowl of the air, and over the cattle, and over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creepeth upon the earth." So God created man in his own image. In the image of God created he him, male and female created he them. And God blessed them. And God said unto them, "Be fruitful and multiply, and replenish the earth, and subdue it, and have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the fowl of the air, and over every living thing that moveth upon the earth." And God said, "Behold, I have given you every herb bearing seed which is upon the face of all the earth, and every tree, in the which is the fruit of a tree yielding seed, to you it shall be for meat. And to every beast of the earth, and to every fowl of the air, and to everything that creepeth upon the earth, wherein there is life, I have given every green herb for meat." And it was so. And God saw everything that he had made, and behold, it was very good. And the evening and the morning were the sixth day. And keep in mind that in chapter 2, it speaks of God on the seventh day, having rested from his work, because he ended his work. And verse 3 says, God blessed the seventh day and sanctified it, because that in it he had rested from all his work, which God created and made. And then we go to chapter 9. And now this chapter, we find Noah after the flood, and God speaking to him. And in a way, it's a time of new beginning. It's a clear parallel to when God spoke to Adam and Eve, which was the beginning. But now we have Noah coming out of the ark with his family. And he hears this from God in chapter 9. We'll just read verses 1 through 7. And God blessed Noah and his sons and said unto them, be fruitful and multiply and replenish the earth. And the fear of you and the dread of you shall be upon every beast of the earth and upon every fowl of the air, upon all that moveth upon the earth and upon all the fish of the sea. Into your hand are they delivered. Every moving thing that liveth shall be meat for you. Even as the green herb have I given you all things. But flesh with the life thereof, which is the blood thereof, shall ye not eat. And surely your blood of your lives will I require. At the hand of every beast will I require it. And at the hand of every man, at the hand of every man's brother will I require the life of man. Whoso sheddeth man's blood, by man shall his blood be shed. For in the image of God made he man. And you be ye fruitful and multiply, bring forth abundantly in the earth and multiply therein. Thus far in the reading of God's holy and precious word. The reason we sang this Psalter, Psalter 14, is based upon Psalm 8. Psalm 8 can be called the echo of Genesis 1 that speaks of the image of God. If I read stanza 4 again of Psalter 14 from Psalm 8, it says, O what is man in thy regard to hold so large a place? And what the Son of Man that thou dost visit him in grace? On man thy wisdom hath bestowed a power well nigh divine. With honor thou hast crowned his head, with glory like to thine. And we could in one phrase explain that all of those words that speak of glory and power and elements of divinity all have to do with this doctrine of the image of God. God said, let us make man in our image. And so we hope to consider that, even as we're considering the command that deals with the prohibition of shedding the blood of man, of murdering one another. We hope to look at this Lord's Day in a foundational way, and in many ways a parallel of what we did with the last Lord's Day that spoke of the command for children to obey their father and mother. We looked at the whole reality of original sin in the heart, and how that is what should be the target of father and mother. That we're not just supposed to train our children to be good imitators and good citizens in this world. We're supposed to realize that we have little children born to us that have a drastic problem, a heart problem. And it's called original sin. And so we focused upon that and saw the horribleness of what original sin is. And the one reality that's where all other sins derive from. And that's what needs to be tackled. That's what we need to inform our children. And so we saw that one verse that spoke of foolishness being bound in the heart of the child. And in the same way, you could see what we're doing today is also looking at this foundational reality. If we are commanded not to kill, and we find in Genesis that the man who sheds blood, his own life will be taken from him. And the reason that God gives is for man has been created with the image of God. So we see that this whole reality of the image of God is bearing upon the great sin and why it is a great sin to shed the blood of others. And so we need to look at this. We need to really understand it. If somebody were to ask you, what is the image of God that you bear? What are some of the words that you could use to describe it? And I wouldn't doubt that if you are like me, if you're just asked that at the very spot of the moment without really having done some homework, there's an element of haziness there. And yet there's some things that we know for sure. We know it has to do something that brings honor to mankind. We know it has to do with something that brings likeness to mankind. But then the problem is added with sin. Well, how much of this image has been marred? Has everything been taken away? What stayed? What left? And so you agree with me that there's a lot of details there. And trust me, as you study this further and further, the more you'll understand how important it is to have a clear understanding of the image of God in your own soul. This will prove to be even the foundational reality in the obedience of all other commands. The reason you are forbidden to bear false witness to another one, or covet what belongs to another one, or the great sin of adultery, which you infringe upon the very body of another one, is precisely because you, who would be committing the sin, and others who would be sinned against, bear the image of God. And even if as we go back one command and think of little children who have to obey their mothers and fathers, you as mothers and fathers must see these little children, although it's true, the whole reality of original sin, it's still true the reality of the image of God in them. And little children, as you see your father and mother, they have the image of God. And that's why you respect and honor them. And so you see that the image of God is not just a little fringe doctrine. It's a foundational doctrine to your everyday life. You have to wake up in the morning and understand the image of God. You have to understand what that means about you. It's not about books. It's not about what theologians think of it. It's not about Adam and Eve. It's about your very heart, your very existence. And so with this introduction, let us look at our first point, the image of God. And what we hope to see here is really, what does this image do? We're not going to look first at what it is precisely. We derive some applications at the very beginning. What we're really going to be seeing is more an application. It seems proper to go this way. Before we see what it really is, we have to realize that it does something to you. It does something to humanity. It does something to the human soul. Something that makes you apart from all other created beings. So what does this image do? This is the first point. Under the first point. So you could call it letter A. What does this image do? But you notice as we were reading in Genesis, the word kind and kind and kind repeated itself. And I want to read it to impress it upon our hearts. In verse 21 of Genesis 1, it says, "And God created great whales and every living creature that moveth, which the waters brought forth abundantly," and here, "after their kind. And every winged fowl after his kind." And all that means is that here are some fowls and some fowls and some fowls, and they all somewhat look different, but they're all fowls. They're all of the same kind. And even as some fish we're seeing here, some fish and some fish and some fish, but they're all of the same kind. There weren't fish that looked like fowls. There weren't fowls that looked like fish in terms of a drastic mixture or complexion. There were kinds. And he keeps repeating this in the course of creation. In verse 24, and God said, let the earth bring forth living creatures after his kind. What were these kinds? There were the cattle, you could say, kind, and the creeping thing kind, and beast of the earth after his kind. And we see this. We look around and we see how they're all different beasts and animals around us, and we call the cat a cat and the dog a dog. They're after their kind. But then in verse 26, we read, and God said, let us make man in our image, after our likeness. And here God used two words, image and likeness. When the group of man is mentioned, it's not just the kindness of man. God connects him. And because he says, let us, we know he's speaking of the Trinity. So that man is after the kind of God himself. Image and likeness does that to humanity. It connects you to God in the most intimate of ties. Now, first we're going to see that one of the ties is that of purpose. The reality that there is this truth of the image of God in man and woman, in humanity, says that you have purpose. A purpose that is distinguished from the purpose of the animals. We have to be careful about this because even animals and all created things have their own purpose. But yet, that purpose that they have does not impel them much beyond what they do. But when humans realize that they have a divine connected purpose, it does something. It raises you above animal kind and makes you acknowledge that your heart, your eyes, your earnest must be heavenward. Let us make man in our image according to our likeness. In essence, God was saying, after our likeness. And you notice that this purpose is not just on the side of man because we receive the likeness and the image. It's in the whole process of what happens. We find God saying, let us make man. And so you see that God is planning. He is conversing. He is dialoguing. And he is thinking of strategy, as it were, you could say. He's thinking of architecture. It's not just a deliberate design of, well, just put man over there. It's let us make man. And you could say, if you stop there, well, that's what God did. He made the animals, he made the cattle, etc. But no, it's let us make man in our image. And so when you think of the purpose of God to make man for a purpose, that immediately gives those who were made under that kind of plan and precept beings that have a purpose. And when you stop with that, you acknowledge that this is precisely the crisis that our culture is in today. The reason there are climactic ascending suicides in people into depression and have absolutely no thought for the future is because of purposelessness. And it goes right in line with their worldview. Evolution's worldview is this world is an accident. Hence, you are an accident. You are only here by the fortuitous forces of chance. You are the survival of the fittest. It is simply what they would call luck. And when you're really honest to the system, you look at it and say, therefore, this world has absolutely no purpose outside of chance and fortune and the forces of luck, whatever all that would be. And we've seen a while back, all of that is powerless. These are idols. These are falsehoods. There's no such thing. And yet when you put your mindset with that kind of thought, you have to be honest to say, well, then this world has absolutely no purpose. But there is a purpose. Because we are not the products of chance. We are not the products of evolution in a mindless way. We are the products of a loving God and a powerful God who planned within the Trinity to create mankind in His image. So purpose is the first thing. And the second thing is that of honor. This is what the image of God does to His created beings who are humans. It brings forth an honor, an element of honor. And you've heard this many times. As God created all those other things and after their days, God said that it was good. But at the end of all His creation, which included then man and woman, God said that it was very good. And this brings honor. Now we got to be careful. You know, often in the minds of men, they think, and you've probably heard how humanity then was the crowning creation of God. There's some truth to the whole reality of the apex being when man was created by God. And yet you have to understand that this honor is not an intrinsic honor. And we really have to say that this is a dependent honor. And if you don't understand this, you become a being that really lessens in the honor that you have. And it doesn't lessen all the way, because as we will hope to see regarding if the fall, what did it cause as an effect into the image, the truth is that there are elements of the image of God that remain. And to that degree, honor remains. But the less you understand this one reality here, the honor will be less and less and less. So when we speak of the image of God doing this to you, it brings an honor to you. This honor only is as honorable as it should be when it's dependent upon this. And the Jewish people understood this because they valued this seventh day so much. This is why I brought to your attention that after God created the world in 6 days, He added to the cycle of creation. In some ways, you could even say that God created, as it were, so that there would be a cycle of 7 days. There was another day and night, and He called it the seventh day, and He blessed it. And later, when we read in the law, we saw that He hallowed it. He set it apart unto Himself. He called it His. And so this is where the honor comes in. Yes, humanity has this pinnacle and sense of the honor they receive. They bear the image of God. But what for? For God. The very next day that man and woman, that man was created, the seventh day, he's there in that day. And we have to imagine that first seventh day, Adam would have been alone. And in that day, he is also resting, contemplating the creation of God. As God rested from His creation and established that day to go into a pattern that is unbreakable. You've probably heard how after the French Revolution, there were men trying to bring in a cycle of 10 days. It was every kind of attempt to try to erase the way God had instituted things. Humanity has not been able to escape this pattern of 7 days. There's an intrinsic reality to the created order. That the way the world revolves around the sun and how the seasons come, that we need 7 days pattern. So man has all this honor upon him, but simply for the sake of honoring and glorifying God. To live, as it were, a Sabbath life, not just the seventh day, Not just the first, as we consider because of the great resurrection of the Lord Jesus Christ. But beloved, what we do here today as we come to ascribe worship to God is what your heart should seek to do 24/7. To live for the glory of God. That's the crowning event of the creation of God. Creating God with the image of God, but for Him. And so it gives man purpose, it gives man honor, but it also gives man identity. It gives you as man and woman your very identity. You see, all those others had an identity. You look at a cow, and she has the identity of a cow. And that one too, although they look different, one's brown and one's black and white. One has horns, one doesn't. But through some basic characteristics, one is identical to the other. And you cannot put it in another category. You know, it's like there are boundaries there in this kind of cow and this kind of cow, but they're all within that big identity of being cows. This is important because when you look at mankind, when you look at God having created man and out of man forming woman, you look at humanity and they have a kind. It's the God-given likeness kind. It's the kind that is connected to God. That's your identity. And you see how it's connected to your purpose. If you have an identity to be like God, to show forth the glory of God, for the world to see something of God in you, if it gives your purpose, that's your honor, that's your identity. There was a pastor who said, you know how it's common that we see there's certain people who are living in ways, and some people say, you know what, they're living like animals. This pastor said that when you say that, it's really a dishonor to animals. Because see, animals don't bear the image of God, and yet they go about their life and they never sin. So when a human who bears the image of God goes out and sins, you know, live like the animal is the idea that they're throwing away law, throwing away dignity, living any old way. But when you find someone living that way, they are living worse than the animals because they bear the image of God still, and yet they throw away that dignity and that honor and want to live below how God caused them to live in their identity. So it's very important to know your identity. And it's in the bearing of this image of God. And so we saw that the image of God gives you purpose, gives you honor, gives you your identity. I won't say much about this, but it's a part of all this, that it's a gift. It's not that you're born and you immediately have it by your own work. It's a gift of God to humanity. That you and I would bear this image. Then fourthly, and it really puts all of these together, that the image of God is your glory. God made man to glorify God, man and women, everyone created must live for the glory of God. And the Bible speaks of when Christ returns, our being glorified. Where there will be no more sin in our hearts and our lives. And yet in this walk we are growing from glory to glory. There's a glory about man and woman. And this glory is completely connected to the image of God. That's where it begins. That's the source of what this glory would be. Calvin, he says this, "The likeness of God extends to the whole excellence by which man's nature towers over all kinds of living creatures." And see, this excellence is an element of glory. It's a weightiness. And always remember the word glory always speaks of weightiness. And that's why I put it last, because it's like adding the weightiness of purpose and the weightiness of honor and the weightiness of identity and the weightiness of a gift that is given by God. He didn't give this to all the other creatures. He did give it to man and woman. He gave it to you. And so it's your glory. It's a glorious thing to bear the image of God. And this is where we see the final element of a verse that just speaks of how truly powerful and real this glory is, and how it gives a big responsibility upon you who bear it. And this is why we read Genesis 9. And of course it's connected with the whole commandment, thou shalt not kill. In Genesis 9 verse 7, it says, verse 6, whoso sheddeth man blood, by man shall his blood be shed. And then God gives the purpose, the reason, for in the image of God made he man. And so God told Noah, and this must have been very connected to the violent ways that mankind was living before the flood, the reason why God brought the flood. There was violence everywhere in the hearts of men, and God instituted, whoever sheds blood, his blood will be shed. Now let's meditate about this for a second. We're speaking of this honor, this glory, this intrinsic value in humankind because of God, connected to God, dependent upon God. And here's someone who is murdered. And so the image of God was erased, as it were, because that person's gone. That person can't live here in the world anymore, announcing this image to others. And it was because this man, who for some violent reason took that life away. And what God was hearing, what Noah was hearing from God, is take this man's life and cause him to cease from breathing. Cause him, who also bears the image of God, to not bear it any longer. So if you're thinking very mathematically, you're thinking, wait, if the image of God is something so important in the soul, shouldn't we not kill this person because he also bears the image of God? And although he did this great misdemeanor, he still bears the image of God, and maybe we should value that in that person. Let him live forever, but maybe with some great punishment. But no, God says, let him die. And so what do we conclude with this? Whoever so disdains the image of God that he takes it upon his hand to obliterate from this world forfeits, and there are two degrees here, forfeits his own life. But that's not as powerful as the second thing that we should say. It's not really his life that is so precious, because that's what's taken away, but his privilege to also go on living, bearing the image of God. God is saying this: those who do not understand the preciousness, the divinity, the connectedness to me of a soul who bears my imprint, as it were, my image, he forfeits the right to bear my image himself. If you do not value my image, you will not live on bearing it yourself. You see, and this whole reality proves that there is a glory that is hard. It's, we cannot as humans plummet the depths of it. But I believe the closer you grow in your life with God, and that you know God the more, and then you understand that you as a human have something of that godness, in, of course, in a way that's not coessential. It's in no blasphemous ways as that, but there's a likeness of a way. Peter calls it a partaking of the divine nature. It's a way that you're even scared that you'll commit blasphemy, because of how connected it is. And yet we don't draw that, we don't cross that boundary into what would be blasphemy, that we become God. It's nothing of that. There have been and there are those who propose that kind of doctrine, that as you grow in Christianity, you become amalgamated with God. No, it's none of that. But it is this. It is a likeness. It is an element of image that you bear. It's not of an angel. It's not of heaven itself. It's of the Creator of your being. And when you see in this command of what would happen to those who disdain that image, then you learn something of what this glory is. And so put all these together. Keep these in mind. It gives you purpose. It gives you honor. It gives you identity. It is a gift. It gives you glory. And beloved, the reason I emphasize these things is if in the beginning of last week somebody were to ask me, tell me what is it that the image of God gives? And maybe I would be able to name maybe one or two of these. I wouldn't have thought so deeply about the identity element or the purpose element. But these things should be in our minds. That the image of God gives you purpose. How practical that can be. If you wake up a morning and you feel, I don't have a sense of purpose. Well, go to the image of God. Consider that you may not have a good agenda for that day. Consider that you must not, maybe don't really, things are confusing, but you bear the image of God. Purpose is not a matter of feeling it or not. You have it. You're just not aware of where it comes from so that you can live your life with that understanding of purpose. It's a very foundational doctrine. And the gravity of those who disdain it show how weighty it is. And weighty means glory. It's an assault then on glory. It is an assault on purpose. It's an assault on this gift from God. It's an assault on the identity that God gives people when any one of us sin against the other. And little children, when you don't want to obey your parents, you are disdaining the image of God, God bestowed upon them. Husband, when you don't honor your wife and love her like Christ loved the church, you are disdaining the image of God upon your wife. Wives, when you don't love your husband in loving submission, you are disdaining the image of God that God imprinted upon your husband. And so it goes for all of our friends, for all of our relations. Yeah, beloved, I pray that if there's any soul that you have a conflict with, you would immediately after this service ask the Lord for grace to solve that conflict. Because any disdaining of another person through a lack of love or hate itself or anger or words that were said that were sinful, repentance has not taken place, forgiveness has not been offered or received, you are with a great problem, not against only another person, but with one who bears the image of Almighty God. You are with a conflict with those who have purpose, identity that is divine related, glory, who receive the gift from God, and you're disdaining that gift. See, our relations with one another are critical to that understanding. And we'll talk more about this in the evening as we consider there in 1 John. We're seeing how John pulls out a command. And which one is it? It's to love your brethren. If you don't love your brethren, you do not walk in the light. Why all that? Well, we're talking about the reasons right now. Ultimately, it's a lack of realizing how precious in the sight of God each soul here is. And the same thing we read about when you take someone's life, you will remember that Jesus puts a parallel regarding any kind of sin. In Matthew 18, Jesus says that if you sin against a little one of these, it would be better to tie that kind of rock that was used for milling grain around your neck and be thrown into the water. You see what Jesus is saying? It's not just those who take blood who deserve to have their blood taken. if you sin against others. Jesus said, if that's how you plan to live, it would be best for you to die. Why? Because those you are sinning against bear the image of God. It hankers back to this very command given to Noah. To the point, beloved, where you cannot have the peace of sleeping. That's why you should not let the sun go down in your anger. Because if you're angry with someone, you are angry with someone who bears the image of God. If you have lied to someone, you've lied to someone who bears the likeness of God. If you have been unfaithful to someone, you have been unfaithful to someone who bears the likeness and image of God. And that brings weightiness to every sin. And even if all your sin has been is directly yourself, an evil thought, and no one knows it, you bear the image of God. And you've sinned against your own soul. Sin is serious, precisely because of who you are, a bearer of the image of God. And now let's talk about what this image is. And I understand that we're still in our first point. I planned all of this, but I didn't know how easy it would be to deliver it all. It's a very profound subject, but probably we'll just see the three points of the first point. So don't be too thinking that we'll be here too long. But let's look at what is this image. And before we do look at this point, let's sing Psalter 352 and then we'll return. 352. So we looked first at what this image does to those who bear it. And it's all humanity. But then let us just end with looking at two verses that will announce to us in very precise ways what this image is. Now, there's been numerous speculation because you saw that as we read in Genesis, God didn't say, let us create man in our image, and this is what is the list of this image, and number one, number two, number three, no. He did say directly after that an element of authority would be connected to that. And God said, let us make man in our image after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish. And many have speculated, well, this element of having dominion is part of that image, and it's clearly connected. But in a outline kind of way, you know, as we looked at what the image does, and we put here the word purpose and honor, etc., the whole concept of authority and dominion is really here regarding what this image implies, the consequences of this image. And dominion is not the only one. And we're going to look here in the middle of what is this image. See, there's something before dominion. What is it about man that allows him to have this dominion? Well, you would say, well, it's the image of God. Yes, but what is that in practice in your own life that enables you to have this dominion? See, you can't go right to dominion. There's something here in the middle. There's a filling in of the blanks that Genesis doesn't give in detail. But it's there because we know this. We know that Adam had no sin. We know that his uprightness was there. And we go to the New Testament and we find out that this element of uprightness is precisely connected to this likeness with God, the image of God. So the two passages that we hope to read in closing today, just to bring out three elements of this image, is first Ephesians 4:24. It brings out two of these elements, and then Colossians 3:10 that brings the third element. And we could say that many other things are connected, but they all branch out from these three things. In Ephesians 4:24 we read, and that ye put on the new man, which after God, see, in the likeness of God and in a connectiveness to God, is created in righteousness and true holiness. And by implication, we will go back to Adam, and we know he was righteous, and we know he was holy before he sinned. And here, when we hear Paul in Ephesians saying that the new man, he receives righteousness and holiness. What we find out is also this dynamic. That here was Adam. When he sinned, that image was marred. When he was saved, that image was renewed. In a sense, this is the summary of our third point, the renewing of the image of God. But we have a lot more to say about this. It's a wonderful point. We need to spend a lot of time. It's the renewing of the image of God that was marred before the fall. Well, next Lord's Day, we hope to consider what this marring did. There are also there conflicting ideas, but the Bible gives a lot of clarity. It's important. If you're not saved today, you are under the very reality of what was marred, and that's the reality about you. And you stand in need of what needs to be renewed. You see how this is a very practical doctrine. But so we find in Ephesians 4:24, what is the image of God is this righteousness and this holiness. But then Colossians 3:10 adds one more word. And in Colossians 3:10, it gives the authority to show that Ephesians is speaking of a renewed likeness of God, renewed image of God, because it uses that phrase, Colossians 3:10. Speaking of those who are believers, he says, and have put on the new man, which is renewed in knowledge after the image of him that created him. And so we have the word knowledge. So that you can go out today with these clear words in your mind. That the elements of the image of God in you are knowledge, righteousness, and holiness. Now, having read this, and having heard that first part where we saw what the image does in you, the words purpose and identity and glory, I want us to read, if we go back to Lord's Day 40, we see here the sixth commandment, and you'll see how it adds power to the reality of the principles revolving the command, thou shalt not kill. When you kill, you're obliterating someone who has the image of God, and that's what makes it bad. So question 105, this is page 76. What does God require in the sixth commandment? That neither in thoughts, nor words, nor gestures, much less in deeds, that's when life is taken literally, I dishonor, hate, wound, or kill my neighbor, by myself or by another. That happens a lot, people paying others to do it. But that I lay aside all desire of revenge. Also that I hurt not myself, nor willfully expose myself to any danger. I spoke about even when you sin against yourself. The element there is you bear the image of God, and that's your great transgression. Wherefore also the magistrate is armed with a sword to prevent murder. And the precise proof of this is what we read in what God told Noah. And then question 106. But this commandment seems only to speak of murder. In forbidding murder, God teaches us that He abhors the causes thereof, such as envy, hatred, anger, and desire of revenge, and that He accounts all these as murder. And the last question, but is it enough that we do not kill any man in the manner mentioned above? No. For when God forbids envy, hatred, and anger, He commands us to love our neighbor as ourselves. Here, the whole positive side. We're not just to be neutral, not hate someone, but just not talk to that person. You know, we've been seeing in John that if you're not talking to someone, that's hating. You need to actively, purposefully do the positive thing, which is to love, to relate. So He commands us to love our neighbor as ourselves, to show patience, peace, meekness, mercy, and all kindness towards him. Everything that would be opposite of taking his life, and prevent his hurt as much as in us lies, and that we do good even to our enemies. Beloved, in this whole phrase, and prevent his hurt as even in our lives, we know what that means. You should be willing to die in preventing the death of others. That's how we should see other human beings, as more valuable than us. And we would do anything to prevent their hurt. So you see how we're going to look at the Lord's Day again in upcoming sermons. But you see with the foundation that we've seen, that we've looked at, how it only increases our understanding. You know, most of us know that murder is bad. But why are we angry? Why do we tolerate lack of patience and the feelings of revenge and of literally harming by speaking evil of others? We learn with this command that these are all akin to murder. And the reason they are despiteful, sinful, abominable things is because of the whole reality of the image of God. And you add to what we said that when you sin against someone, you sin against the honor and the glory and the identity that God gave because of the image of God. But add this too, the knowledge and the holiness and the righteousness of those who are renewed with that image. You know what that means? It means that when you sin against another Christian, it is a greater sin than when you sin against an unbeliever. Because you're sinning against someone who now has the renewed image of God. Knowledge, righteousness, and holiness is what you regain when you're saved. And that, of course, shows that those who are not saved do not have this knowledge that is heavenward, do not have the righteousness that is inward, and do not have the holiness. And see how these three are so complete. The knowledge, when you understand the Word, you understand who you are, you understand the image of God, you understand original sin, you understand how it offends God. See, your mind is mindful of these truths. You have a righteousness because your sins have been cleansed at your state before God. And you have a holiness. And you could think of holiness as your hands going out and doing good. Being what you are inside your heart. So you see, if everything about you is sinful, it's because you don't have that righteousness inside. And I know that many of us as believers aren't living up to the knowledge that we should and showing the righteousness we have through our holiness. But when you realize that that's what it means to bear the image of God, and if you claim to be born again, and all the honor, all the glory, that can be used even in a sinful way to bring pride in the heart. But if you truly bear the image, you'll understand, no, but with holiness, pride cannot be there. And then you can understand that thing that I said, that the honor is a dependent honor. You really only have as much honor that really will be an honor that will please the Lord if you're using who you are for the glory of God. Because in the same way, if a believer or an unbeliever sins against a believer, it's a greater sin because of the image of God renewed. It's also a greater sin if you who are a believer sin. An unbeliever has an element of the image of God, but not the knowledge, righteousness, and holiness. And he or she sins. A true believer has this new man and sins. That's a greater sin. And so I hope that these truths can bring a lot of meditation to your heart. And primarily this, how important it is that we walk carefully our days, relate to one another, with fear in your heart. Whenever there's sin, that you would be fast to repent, Be slow to anger. Listen to one another. And seek to love God with all your heart and your neighbor as Christ has loved you because of the image of God you bear. Let us close in prayer.